done that one to death. Chapter 9? Okay, chapter 10.
This one deals with the narrative aspects of the interview, narrative interviews. And I thought it was interesting when they pointed out that narratives assume that the story has structure in itself. So it's not so much externally imposed structure, it's more you have to find the structure. Like a story, there's a beginning, a middle, and an end.
And they're supposed to be interesting.
Hopefully, right?
The perfect world.
Yeah, lots of assumptions we make about stories.
Yeah. And so there's two types of interviews identified as narratives. There's the narrative interview and the episodic interview. So the narrative interview, the interviewee is asked to present the story or the history of a specific area in which he or she participated somehow. So they're an expert because of their participation. So this is biographical research is mostly the narrative interview. There's three stages. You begin with a generative narrative question, which is kind of the topic. And it's interesting because it can't be too wide, because then you'll sort of get off topic and be meandering. And it can't be too narrow, ambiguous of any sort, because it'll end up with sort of a disjointed presentation. The middle part is the interviewer really doesn't have too much to do in the middle part. They kind of appear prompt if the interviewee needs help clarifying or carrying on, but minimal intervention there. And then in the balancing phase, the interviewer comes back in, and it's kind of a phase that appears to include some analysis. And they start looking at why or interpretations of events, and so the interviewer kind of seems to guide more there. An interesting point they noted, for this type of interview, the interviewee shouldn't really be interrupted as they're telling their tale, unless they need prompting. The story is hoped to take a life of its own during the recounting. Hopefully that'll carry along and through the three stages, beginning, middle, end. Interestingly, it's noted people know more and will present more about their own lives than they think, than generally is in their perception of themselves. I thought that was interesting. I also thought it was interesting that they said the information given is about one individual, but you can actually compare biographies to develop kind of patterns amongst groups of people. I thought that was interesting. I hadn't really thought of that before. So it's kind of like a quantitative trend analysis without being that way, right? It's kind of a qualitative
trend analysis.
An advantage of the narrative interview is that the story can be contextualized against what was happening in the social context, the historical context of the time. So you can kind of get that comparing there. This, I did this while this was going on. During World War II, I did this. But there's a few problems, possible problems. The interviewee can be expecting more questions than they're given, so they might not be able to carry it on their own, and that's a potential problem. The interviewee just might not like talking about themselves, or just might not be used to it, in which case this might not be the best method because nothing will happen. Mm-hmm. Also, the memories of earlier events can become distorted due to time or situation. I took that to mean that, of course, if a lot of time passes, you start to sort of reconfigure some of the memories and stuff, so that could impact things. But also, if you're trying to please the interviewer or that kind of, like, kind of contextual factor, I thought that would
come. Another thing with early memories, and I think, is that kids are told by their parents, well, remember when you were little, mm-hmm. and you don't really remember, but you remember the story and I'm telling it, so you tell story that
you have a picture, a photo album, kind of something like that.
My Hell's Gate story, you guys thought it would be nuts. anybody else been to Hell's Gate?
To hear about
this. Out in Fraser Valley? Oh, it's this air tram that goes from this highway down to this little touristy place right above Fraser, at this junction of the Fraser River called Hell's Gate, because when they were building the railway, they collapsed and the water backed up. But my parents always told me when we drove past it, we'll go there next time, because I always wanted to go. But there are pictures in a couple of photo albums of me and my brothers in front of the place, because we never paid to go in. they took pictures at a young age of us, and they always tried to tell me whenever I brought it up, well, don't you remember we went? Here's the picture. And for the longest time, I kind of accepted that. And then I tried to think about, well, I've never been to the fudge place down there. And so last summer I went, and quite a power experience.
Had you been there when you were little?
No, we've driven past many times.
What was the picture of?
Us standing in front of the air tram.
And your parents tried to convince you that you were
there. There are other pictures as well.
The parental fake out.
Well, I think the logic was they could build that memory.
Without paying for it.
Without paying for it. Don't you remember that air tram? Don't you remember the Barkerville? Don't you remember all these things?
Riding in the car.
Yeah.
Having lunch.
I think we need to have your parents in for an interview.
Well, now you know why recovered memories became such a hot issue over childhood sexual abuse. Reconstructed nature. Of
I have a question, though, just in regards to this interview, which is much more serious. The researcher, what constitutes legitimate access to the story of the interviewee? And what I mean by that is, let's say you're looking at an interview transcript. You didn't do the interview yourself of someone from a different culture, someone who is perhaps living in India or living in Africa, third world, in poverty, and you're a first world researcher. How do you access that story if the cultural references, if the artifacts that are being talked about are not native to you? And then how legitimate can the analysis be of that?
You want to go into the realm of ethnographic research.
I guess what I was seeing, just in regard to the story here, if someone at least tells me her story, her personal biography, her narrative, mm-hmm. I can probably access it because we do share enough of a worldview. Mm-hmm. But at what point can I, what point of the research do I have to say, well, I can't access this?
Mm-hmm.
Nothing measures to try to be able to access it? Like, spend more time in research, talk to more people.
Well, I'm sure I could, but another example that I was thinking about is I'm reading a transcript where I'm doing an interview of a woman that's been sexually assaulted. I'm a man. I've never been sexually assaulted. How much can I access of her story?
Mm-hmm.
And I guess I'd have to pick a particular analysis tool or a different methodology in my analysis that would allow me to access elements of it, but I've never accessed the entire story.
Well, you'd never get the entire story anyway. I mean, you're only going to get what she's wanting to present, and there's no reason why you shouldn't be able to interpret a level of understanding from it any less than anyone else. It doesn't mean that your interpretations it doesn't mean that other people's interpretations could be different, right? It could come at it from different, they could see different things into it. But there's still a level at which meaning has been constructed between your interpretation of the account and what the person presented. That's the level you'd have to work at.
So you have to then?
You would, you'd have credibility in your interpretations by acknowledging the place that you're coming at. But again, I throw that question again. Why should your interpretation be any less valid than anyone else's? And perhaps the very fact that you are a man who's never been through those experiences means that you're able to place some of the meaning that's constructed in a different way, frame it in a different way, thereby furthering our understanding at another level. That was a very non-feminist response, but one I think is true.
Thank you. Drawing this conversation back to where Kim left off, is there a technical term for the bias to try and please the interviewer? I seem to remember there's some nice way to phrase that.
Oh, yeah, trying to please the interview?
Yeah.
Yeah, social desirability.
And the last point I have for narrative interviews was a potential problem is that you end up with a lot of unstructured text that is a challenge for interpreting because it's just sort of wherever the interviewer wanted to go, well, that's where you went.
Pick two.
is the episodic interview. And the deal with this one is it focuses on specific experiences or specific episodes of experience. So it's much more concrete in terms of the situations and experiences that are being accessed. And the term that's included here is semantic knowledge as well. Semantic knowledge is based on abstraction from the episode. So what I took from that was like once you sort of talked about the incident or the situation, I took it that the interviewer would then kind of ask some of the why questions again. Mm-hmm. Is that kind of what semantic knowledge was? More of the abstract interpretation of it?
Yeah.
Yeah. I wasn't too clear on
the way the expression.
Yeah, like more of the what the significance of the experience was, more of the. Yeah, I wasn't quite sure what the semantics. I didn't quite get that, but I understood it as generalizations or abstractions. I can hear.
Is it like a conversation analysis type thing? Or?
No.
No.
It's where you use a word too, and then you attribute different meanings.
Right, yeah. So that's what I'm reading into it too. It's what that's about more is just what meaning is being generated by what the person's described. So the first part's describing the situation, and the other is what meaning is coming out of that situation.
You find that with, or I've seen that with, I don't know, just. With some people, they sort of they have a tendency to take a word and then they seem to use it to capture. It's like there's something in their psyche they're trying to capture, and they decide that that word is what they're going to use to capture that psychological phenomenon.
Mm-hmm.
So, and it just becomes it sort of becomes encompassing, and you kind of well, exactly what do you mean by?
Mm-hmm.
This when you use this word, what does it mean? What aspect of your experience does it capture?
Yeah.
So.
And there's a sense in which a person will feel that it's understood what they're saying. That word that they've latched onto is really conveying the meaning, but it maybe isn't always. And in fact, people can get caught up in loops with that. Have you ever seen it? So they're using a certain metaphor to describe their experience, and then they keep using it and using it, and eventually they're realizing that it's not really like that at all, actually, but, it's hard to leave it.
My mother-in-law uses the word funny when she's really being nasty and mean about someone. She's a funny girl, or it's a funny situation, it's a funny, and it's taken me this many years to sort of understand that there's a very, very clear, there's her own sort of scheme, culturally, everything. It's just, it takes a while to get to know what she means when she says that something's funny. And it has nothing to do with humor. So, but that, that's her special meaning. So that's where the semantic, that's what I thought when I read that.
There are some words that have socially constructed meanings, such as, you take the phrase, not bad. And in some context, it may not bad actually means pretty good.
Yes.
And sometimes it means not bad means,
absolutely.
Something
like
that.
Is that conversation analysis that we're doing right now? Just looking at words and the different meanings attached to the different words?
Can
you
not take that? Mm.
Discourse
analysis,
yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
But if you took larger idea, like the diagram shows it more as a concept,
mm-hmm.
So it's not working at the level of a word anymore.
Okay.
It's taking it beyond and looking more at a general schema that someone might have and understanding what that would be.
But in those cases, is it the individual general schema or the cultural nuance?
Or the what?
Cultural nuance of just the language.
Could it really be personal subjective though?
But not bad. It does have a meaning independent
mm-hmm.
from that individual, from the culture which they use. And so that person, that is a separate concept of the schema, but it draws its meaning from not necessarily that individual, it draws its meaning from the overall culture.
But in the interaction of the account that's taking place, it's drawing its meaning from the context that person's placed it in. Right? And that's why we...
Only within that context?
Well, it would be at that moment, in that given moment, right? That person's conveying a meaning in the context of everything else they're saying that, let's say, in that example, is not what, you know, too, that's bad or too bad means perhaps in other contexts. Some words are often, I mean, very ambiguous. I mean, we might say how something is a... thinking of the way in which the word performance, for example, gets used to mean many, many different things, but the meaning is clear by the context, and authors will often write that. I won't be describing them, you know, I won't be saying what, defining what my use of performance means, because it will become clear by the context, the use that I'm making of it. Okay? And we do the same thing when we look at the talk.
What I got out of this chapter is that it's the whole point of this type of research is to draw out the context and between different groups. Like they say, therefore research questions may have mainly up to now focused on group-specific differences and experiences in everyday knowledge. The comparison between certain groups is the goal of sampling cases. So in my case, I would use this research in order to figure out how entrepreneurs thought of networking, whether they thought it was a waste of time or whether they thought it was best things since I've read.
Yeah.
And that's very context specific, so I would really draw out the differences between those two groups.
Yeah. And the way in which they would be, the different words they would use to describe what they're thinking would be, in that case, then context specific again, right? It would get its meaning from the way they're describing the whole of what you're after. Right? Okay, another example. Take it right back again to poor Diana, Princess Diana and Daunting, right? That was a semantic idea right there, right? The word daunting was used and meant a different thing based on the context, which we understood. The meaning was clear to us, how she was using the term.
She was using the term, or was it a place to describe
it? She did use it in the end.
Both. Okay.
The last point I found interesting about this was, narrative interviews, I often think of them as being quite natural and flowing and interview-centered, but in the episodic interview section, it mentioned that episodic interviews could be considered less artificial than narrative ones because there's more dialogue, where it's the give and take is not just one person talking and talking and talking. That's what I thought of that one.
Okay. If you ever get really interested in this kind of narrative idea, and you want to look at it in an alternative way to McAdams, okay, is I highly recommend Mishler's book. Just looking for the name. It's 1986. Yeah, they don't. It's not listed in the index here because the 1986 here is just an article called Narrative Psychology. I think it's called Narrative Interviewing, the book. But I'll double check and bring it in, or I'll put it on the email to you because it's very seminal kind of important work.
Is the name Mishler?
Mishler. Thank you, Cam.